My name is Franco B. I was born in Milano in 1962, just last January. I live in London since 1979. I left Italy when I was 19. I came here to avoid the national service that at the time was obligatory, and I didn't want to do it. And then after a stint working in kitchen as a wash up, I decided to go to art school. And then at 26, I got into Camberwell to the foundation. And at 27, I got into Chelsea to do painting. And in 1990, I came out of Chelsea. And since then, I've been a practitioner. Yeah.
Can you tell us something about your childhood? How you grew up, your parents?
Yes. Well, my first memory is when I was around five, and I remember I was in an institution, in an orphanage, and a priest was pissed off with me because I peed in bed, and so he took me to the toilet and put me on the wall of the toilet. There was a wall in between, you know, that separated the toilet and the sinks on this side, and he put me there and said, "This is where you have to pee. This is where you pee." I don't remember how long I was left there, but I remember an eternity, and I remember that the kids would come in and they would laugh at me, you know. And I was on this wall that probably wasn't very high, but I was very small. So, you know, I don't remember what happened then, but that's one memory. Then my third memory is when I was seven, I come back from school when I was at the orphanage, and I went into a room, and they said, "Somebody's come to see you." And through the glass door, which was frosted, I see a shadow. And I remember, I didn't know who it was. And then when she came through, this person came in, they said, "This is your mother, you're going with her." And so that's my second, that is really. And then really 3 years later, I find myself back in institution because things didn't work out. Making the story short, things didn't really work out, and I end up being between the age of 10 and 14 in an institution run by the Red Cross, the Italian Red Cross, for children that was, that some kind of problem because of the family, you know, ironically. So at 14 and a half, they didn't know what to do with me. So they washed their hands and they went back to live with my mother and my stepfather for a year and a half. And then before I was 16, I ran away from home with my stepfather chasing me down the street with a knife and in underpants in the middle of the winter. And that was the last time I saw my stepfather. Yeah. And then till 91. And I spent 2.5 years away from home working I ended up working in a kitchen in a pizzeria, where they give me to sleep, and they took me in, and I was doing working for them. And then I decided to leave Italy, and I went to France, then find myself getting a boat. I was gonna go to Holland, but then instead we came here, and then obviously, and then my identity card was not valid, and I didn't want to go back to Italy, so then I was stuck here till the Italian gave me a passport in 91. In the meantime, I did my education, I found what I wanted to do.
What made you decide to become an artist?
Well, I think it's a kind of classic. There was a moment that when I was 22, 23, that I got disillusioned with politics. I was very involved with anarchist politics from the age of, via punk. Then I got seriously involved with anarchist groups, not the fuck you chaos sex pistol, but more like the crass, the pacifist group, the poison girls, that kind of group, you know, da-da-da-da. And through them I got involved with an anarchist bookshop. And then I got disillusioned with them because I had this utopian ideal of anarchism, that everything was okay, that everybody tolerated each other, and that there was no homophobia, there was no racism, there no was misogynist. And then, of course, among these people, I realized they were as racist as everybody else, as homophobic as everybody else. And I got really depressed. I got to start to shoot up a lot of speed, and I felt suicidal. And one day, a girl, I think, liked me, stopped me and said, I see you every day, you know, what are you doing? Why you look miserable? You don't. And when she stopped me, it was 8 months, I didn't talk to anyone. I wasn't talking to anyone, except where I was working as a washing up. I would just do my job, and I didn't have any interaction outside work. I was just on speed and living my life, in my flat, and just taking a lot of drugs, alone usually, and like no sleeping for days. And then she said, oh, what's wrong, you know, why don't you, I'm depressed, okay, fuck off, you know, leave me alone. Oh, why don't you come to pottery classes? Bristol, I remember the class was a pound for a term, you know, the old IEA, you know, steam before touch dismantled it.
Yeah.
Because that was 83, you know, she hadn't yet done the big damage. And so I followed her. I went and that changed my life. There was the moment I asked myself, but you have to make a decision. Do you want to die before you're 25, or do you want to take hold of your life? And I decided art was going to be my salvation. You know, it was going to be, I decided that was it. You know, and of course, at the beginning it was probably very, what you call it, messy, you know, and it was like just a scream, you know? Everything I did was a scream, you know? In a sense, and not a scream in a cool sense, but a scream is just like help, you know? It's just like inhibited, and, you know? And then somebody, the guy, there was a really nice guy that now died of cancer a few years back, that was teaching pottery. I also met Stone Art School, and he said, why don't you go to art school? Why don't you know, you should go to art school. I said, oh, I don't have any education. I didn't have all that. I said, oh, they'll take you, you're a mature student. You know, you have some, you know, they'll take people like you. So I applied to Camberwell because I lived near there. And also because they had a ceramic department. So he said, they'll probably take you on a foundation there. And then, you know, you could go on and do a ceramic course. Because when I got to Camberwell, I decided I didn't want to do ceramic. I wanted to do a lot of other things. And so I went for painting at Chelsea, because I started at Chelsea. At that time, you know, in 86, it was the place where you could, you could cross over, you know? And you could also be, you know, in a way, be a failure, in a way, as a painter, and then do something else. Like they have this alternative learning media set up from the late 60s, which was set up for that. It was set up because there was sculpture painters that go in and then didn't want to do painting. So then they set up this thing, which had video system meal, you know, which then they dismantled, you know. But I was lucky. There was a brilliant guy at the time called Stuart Marshall. Mm-hmm. A brilliant, brilliant guy. And then he died a year after of AIDS. And so I was very lucky. Really, the moment I got free education, you know. And then, you know, before they dismantled, they started, they were, by then was already, but when I was at Chelsea, we occupied the college. There was this horrible guy Mackenzie, but then to cover Leeds United, horrible. On stage. Horrible, horrible guy. But anyway, and started to do performance for camera, and in my flat I had a two-bedroom, and I would do things at the weekend, and I would advertise them on Time Out. And then in 95, 94, 95, I met Lois Kidan, and she invited me at the ICA to do a they had a platform thing, you know, on once Wednesday of the month. And then, you know, because the rest is history. There was, when I was at Chelsea, the most important piece is when I'm, which was difficult being at Chelsea, but although I had a really supportive, but people were worried about my mental health. And they were, you know, and they were worried. But I had a support from Stuart, but, you know, I think he had problem with some of the other people. The painters didn't like it, you know, because they said I was a self-harmer. And I did a piece, I made a film where I cut it. It was a response of Operation Spana, this big court case, which one of the, you know, this this period, you know, torture and very, very suppressive. Anyway, these people got arrested for having sexual consent, mature, you know, SM sex, and they got arrested. And they were, there was a big court case. Even they went to the European Court of Human Rights and they lost there. Where basically the state says that it has a right to protect you from your desire. And that was a moment for me, catalytic, you know. Although I already had this from a point of view of Catholic, Roman Catholic mm-hmm. upbringing in institution, where, you know, the priest asked you if you touch yourself, mm-hmm. you know, from the age of 11, mm-hmm. do you touch yourself, mm-hmm. and he meant, do you masturbate, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then stuff like that, oh, I can see in the class, you know, that kind of almost like, if you're a kid, you think it's witch hunting, you know, everybody, no, it's not me, do I look like that, you know, that kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, sure, then guilt.
So this is a very important piece. And then the most important thing after that, it was I'm Not Your Babe. The first time that I actually bleed, not on camera, but in front of a public, which was with Lois. But it wasn't the first performance. Although the first performance I did, I say, I had blood. It was my blood, but it was collected before. I actually didn't have, but, and then I, for the first time, I did this piece where I was just bleeding for 11 minutes. So that was a very important piece for a lot of reasons. Also, there was a kind of, I realized I crossed the line, you know, and whatever I like to know, people are going to remember me for that, the bleeding man, the guy that bleeds, you know. And for many years, even now, you know, some people won't know who I am, but if you say, you know, if you say, oh, I used to bleed, oh, the bloodletting, you're the bloodletting, old guy, painted white, yeah, they know.
Yeah.
And the same if you're in museums, you know, especially in England, the curator, you try to get you know, get to meet you. You say Franco, Frankie B, Franco Boo, you know, and then I say, well, what work do you do? And say, well, I used to do. You know? Oh, no, we don't do any body art. How we don't have any body art program? So wait a moment, I put the phone down.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
So when you made the first piece like that, and it had a strong effect, were you using yourself? I mean, because you often cover your identity or you change your identity when you bleed as a performer.
Well, so I did, yeah.
Did you, were you doing that for the first ones?
Yeah, I did. I painted myself white to avoid to originally, because I thought it was to cover the tattoo, but I think it's more subtle than that. I think there's more, you know, more. I think I actually realized 10 years later that in a way it was a costume, you know, and I was that, in a way I wasn't naked. So the last bleeding I ever did it without the makeup, and I did a Colchester art center with Anthony Roberts. Mm-hmm. And I was really strong, and I felt liberated. And that was the last time I bled without a bled. And then, I mean, then when I said the last time I bled, it's not true, because in a way I think we bleed all the time. We always bleed, and then actually to talk about life or blood or death, you don't have to show it. You can talk about, you know, a lot of things without being so literal. You know, at the moment, at the time was very important. At the time, because at the time I did the performance, it's not where the piece started. The piece started 10 years before, when there was a lot of repression and stuff like that. Then eventually you get to do it. You get to find a guy that would support you, that would help. You know, I found a doctor, a gay doctor that was very poor friend, that trusted me and was willing to take care, you know, to risk it, no? And he helped me, you know? And it was interesting, because also he was also on the ethical committee at the BMA, and he would then bring this, what he did with me, assistance as an item. You say, you know,
interesting.
What artists have at this artist's way, you know, and of course, he found a lot of walls, you know, people say, you're crazy, you should not beg these people need help, you know?
Yeah.
And so so it was interesting, you know, to kind of, in a way, to be part of that thought, you know?
Mm.
At least here, you know? I mean, you know, this would never happen in Italy, you know?
Yeah, that, no.
You know? And so it's interesting, because then after a while I found out through a friend in Italy that if I ever needed a doctor, there was people that would help me, you know, anonymously, you know, stuff like that. But actually Paddy, which is also still a very good friend of mine, is a top GP in London. He's a top GP practitioner, you know, he runs his own practice. He works for the medical union, he's on a BA medic committees, other committees. He's a bit, you know, he's a way, be what you call it, open, like going on camera and say, you know, I'm prepared to support this, you know, because it's done, if it's done, you know, not in a control, but it's done, this, you know, it's sure, about ownership, sure. He's asking this question. And maybe, you know, and also then he'll talk about Orlan, you know, and others,
yeah.
You know. So, because, and so this was very interesting, was very important, you know, because obviously, you know, we forget, you know, how, in a way, we were backwards 5 years ago, you know, things are really fast now. And so then, of course, as I said at the beginning, I realized I was in trouble, because I would be remembered for this. And then it took me really 5 years to stop physically doing it, because every time I say I'm not doing it, people contact me, they want the bleeding performance, they didn't want anything else, you know?
Yeah.
They didn't want it, you know? As soon as I say, actually, I'm doing some, they didn't want it, and this, you know, and it's interesting, you know, because actually, if you think about it, it was easier to me to work when I bled.
Sure.
Yeah.
But one of
and now if a festival contacts me and I say I'm working on a dance piece, they don't take me seriously, you know?
But that's strange, because anyone who ever saw one of your performances, the thing you actually remember is your presence.
Yes.
The presence you give to the audience, the kind of atmosphere of you as a human being, as the most human being in the room.
Yeah.
The blood, in a way, is a kind of a metaphor for humanity.
Yes,
so if you
exactly.
actually see one, you understand it.
Yes.
Perhaps there's a problem with photographs.
It's not just photographs, also videos. Yes.
Yeah.
Because people would have seen it, but now you go on, you go on YouTube, you see them, but also the Tate example. Tate Modern still has on the video online, on the video, what you call it. You can see it, you can be a part of the program on the live culture thing. So a lot of people would come to me via this video, you know, And then, yeah, but also, you know, of course, yeah, I realized, so it took 5 years to stop, because also I felt insecure, you know? Mm. I felt very insecure, when I said, this is the last time, then suddenly I felt very insecure, you know, what I'm gonna do, you know, and stuff, you know? And but it's also very interesting, as soon as I start not physically perform, people also wanted to pay me less. You know, it's interesting. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
That's terrible.
Yeah, but also, oh, now you don't bleed anymore, because when I bled, I would do 3 a year, you know, so I could ask for 6,000, 7,000, yeah. But now people want to pay you 2,000 if you're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, you can do another one this week, or you can do one every night, you know. It's interesting, you know. Also, maybe now there's less money around, but, you know, obviously across Europe as well. But of course, in Europe, is still, you know, especially Northern Europe, is still, I think, much more, you know, much more funded things like performance, you know. So,
so just to go, so the persona, the in the bleeding works, it seems to me very much an extension of the being alone, not loneliness.
Of being alone
that you've been through your life.
Also, but also I think it's a way to meet people, you know, it's a way to connect with people. And also, of course, at the beginning, there was a statement, obviously, the undertone was there's a lot of personal politics, you know, it's my body. And then, of course, the context changed, you know. 5 years later, I mean, when I started, you know, there was a war, you know, there was a war in Yugoslavia, when on a Sunday you see this body, there was the first Gulf War, you know, Kuwait, you know, and suddenly you have these images on TV, you can see them, what does it mean, you know, it's just a, and now people are used to see body, dead body, Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere, you know, so things change, you know, and I think you can talk about, it's like what I'm working on at the moment, you know, I'm still talking about the same things, about being alone and about doing things because of love, because of lack of love, because of the anger of love, you know, or because of wanted to be loved, etc., etc. And also I'm very much interested to talk about also not just me as a human being, but also more like how me as an animal, you know, like as an animal, as a member of the animal species. At the moment I'm working a lot on memory, not just my memory, but memory of things that touched me. I saw a film when I was in my 30s called My Life as a Dog. And it was always stayed in my head that the relationship, the boy that is losing, every boy is losing the mother, he's lost the dog because they put it down, because they can't look after it for him, and the brother is a piece of shit. And every time he has a crisis, which is, you know, a real crisis, something emotional, you know, that he's confronted with, he uses this this dog Laika as an example, actually that his life is not as bad, you know, as that he's, that in a way his condition, you know, is not as bad as was happened to this poor dog that was sent in space with no food and still around, you know. So in a way that memory is now a basis for this work I'm doing at the moment, you know, making a reference to Laika and these stupid things that people do, you know, that we, you know, Homo sapiens, you know, do to not only to other animal, which is an animal, but also to other people, you know? You know, like you can see, you know, the way we treat refugees, the way we treat children, you know, et cetera, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. And also, you know, when I grew up, when I was like in my 22, 23, I realized that, you know, when I was younger, I realized I didn't have any power. And when I was 21, 22, I thought I might become a nurse, yeah? Because I thought, well, maybe this is what I should try to educate us while I was washing my plate. I knew I didn't want to do that. And so I went and did voluntary service with Age Concern, and I would visit people at home. And then they asked me if I would go to visit people in a geriatric ward. In a long stay meant that most likely people would die there. Mm. And so, and I realized also, and the reason why I didn't pursue it is because it was too depressing. It was too depressing to deal with death. You know, for me, that was like in your face, and people that you meet, the next time we went in, there was somebody else in the bed, and they were replaced, you know. The first time you asked what's happened to Jace, or what's happened to Margaret, you know, and the second time you don't ask, you know, you realize that somebody else, and you know, sometime, you know, next time I come in a week, you know, there'll be somebody else, some other poor, you know. And so, I realized that I wouldn't have been a good care because I was too emotionally fucked up myself. That I wouldn't have not, I don't know what would happen. You know, I was a mess every time somebody died. So, I mean, you know. Mm. And also, I didn't want to suddenly become tough to do the job. I just decided that art was. Because actually, the sister of the ward, they wanted me to go into nursing because they said I would be a brilliant nurse, because, you know. Because I was, you know, and I was a punk, I remember, but nobody could touch me. Because, you know, the sister of the ward, you know, said I was a good worker. You know, basically I became a free, you know, auxiliary nurse, you know, unqualified care, you know. I would work at Christmas, I would do voluntary service, you know. And then she gave me reference and she said, you know, you just need to do your level. And then you can get into a nursing school, but you must have your A level. You must do your level, you know, do evening classes. And I decided, no, I'm going to do art. Yeah, and so I did that. And because of this, and I realized, you know, that there's something that I realized that there was this parallel between being young, that you're too young to have a voice, and too old to have a voice, you know?
Yeah.
And it's terrible, you know? And so, and this is, I think, not in reference to being young, because it doesn't affect me anymore, but certainly getting older, I'm very concerned about now, especially to try to stay healthy and to try to think, you know, what would happen if suddenly I get a stroke and I'm fucked and I can't, you know, ideally, I always say to myself, I want to take a shot of heroin, but you're not going to be able to go down, you know, some crack house and so, you know, you know, you're going to be in a wheelchair and nobody's going to do it for you, you know, nobody's going to do it for you. I mean, the cliché, kill me if I get in that state. Nobody's going to do that for you, you know, so, and also maybe you shouldn't expect that, you shouldn't, you know, so I'm thinking, you know, obviously I don't have issue with dying, but certainly, I want to keep my dignity. Yeah, I don't want to be in a bed, getting bed sore, and treated like somebody.
That's a word, it's an interesting word, dignity.
Yeah.
Because it's something that your performances, all of your performances have had dignity.
Mm.
And it's kind of the dignity of the individual man.
Yes.
Telling us about ourselves.
Yes,
that was a very strong part of what you do.
Yes, and because the way I try, because the way, you know, obviously I talk about things that are very personal, but at the same time they are, you know, because they're not in third person and they're not in first person. They're images, you know, in a way I try, you know, if it's possible, I'm trying to create images which are important, work that's important to me without being just about me, no. Because I think it's not about me, but it's about this problem that we all have, this condition which is called, you know, being a human being, and which means that we have this notion of being better, and we have this notion of having right, you know, over others, and which is problematic, And I'm not a pacifist, yeah, and I'm not a religious person. Mm. It's not, you know, some kind of Christian hippie. No, I just feel, yes, of course, like in anything, it's, you can't avoid being, you know, the contradiction, you know, the bombs waiting for you, you know, in a way, because the traps, you know, and that's interesting, because obviously every day there's traps, you know, and that you are the set yourself up to, because you're not Mr. Perfect, Mr. Right.
No, no.
It doesn't, you know? So what you're doing, you know, you're just, in a way, you just illustrate what is obvious.
Yeah. From the other side, about audience, how you think about audience, how you think about people?
Well, I think I see them as people, like me. I usually don't refer to them as public or audience, but more as people. So I try to refer to them at the, you know, as active as possible, although they're not. And of course, also I know that in a lot of situations, you know, obviously the performance is the one in control, you know, and also in a way you're setting this up. So that whatever you like or not, there is not this equality that you liked to believe there is, because there isn't, because at the end, you know, somebody does something stupid during your performance, you say you're a dickhead, you know? I have to take responsibility for what a dickhead does, but at the same time, I can't be surprised about it, because in a way, that is one of the trap. I set myself up for it, and I invite it, you know, so interesting. And I think probably I would do the same, you know, if I was invited, you know, if I felt that, because it's a big if, because obviously we can take that, we can take the sign, you know, we can take that as our own sign, because, you know, the situation you think, oh, I felt, you know, I felt this was, I felt I wanted to do this, but I felt it was okay. Mm-hmm. But of course it's okay in your head, you know, and maybe it's okay in the aftermath, you know, but actually, you know, maybe it wasn't, you know. So in a way, you have to deal with, you know, the if and the but, as maybe it's better sometime to just be spontaneous. And to be spontaneous and make a fool of yourself, then as long as it was done with respect, as long as it wasn't, you know, I'm louder than you kind of thing, or you're stupid, you know, but more like, to really try somebody, you know, I always find interesting, I always think that I'm responding to invitations, you know? And of course, some invitation have a carrot in front, you know, like, would you like to do this, you know? And of course, you know, we give you 2,000, you know? And sometimes, but I like this idea that in a way, it doesn't matter whether it's a job or not a job. In a way, everything is a job, you know? Everything is a job. And, you know, job of food, job of being alive, you know, job of needing to communicate, need to eat, more than one level, obviously, we're talking just
sure.
But, you know, we need food, we need to be, we need to be loved, we need, you know, we need to feel, you know, some kind of viability, you know.
Do you think you are an amplifier?
No, I'm not. I think I'm just one of the sound. I'm not an amplifier. I'm one of the noises, and there's many noises. No, I don't think, I think the amplifier is not, maybe, I've never seen somebody as an amplifier, but maybe the structure, you know, the building, you know, or the context. But I think people maybe are just noises.
Yeah.
Pure noises, you know, even if we don't hear it. Why noise? Noise that make you sick, noise that make you repulsive, noise that make you depressed, you know.
I was thinking about those in the audience that you allow by imagination to be you in a way that you bring something out in there.
But the thing is, at the end, you know, at the end, whatever you are, a nice person or not, being an artist, you know, to be able to do this in front of people, you know, is very personally highly rewarded, you know? And in a way, it's a very selfish thing to do, I think. But at the same time, you know, in a way, you're not in control of whatever somebody's gonna do something good with it or not.
Sure.
To say that you are, I think, you are misconceived. You are a pion ass. So what I take from is that I take what is useful from what I can see, what I can receive, what I'm aware, and the same. I hope I can be useful, and people take what is useful from me. So in a way, you know. And it's not about purely about exchange and being, you know, a good anarchist, a good community person, but it's, I think everything at the end stands from a selfish point of view. You know, I need that. I mean, you know, I'm not doing it because, you know, I'm the sweetest and the most generous. This is the interesting thing, you know, when people will say, oh, Frank, you're so generous. I'm not, you know. Because generous is not just about giving money to people. It's not about, you know, in a way, you know, it sounds horrible thing to say, you know, I need to do that. Maybe because of whatever my neurosis, my paranoia, my, you know, I feel less, I feel more useful. It has more sense to me than it makes sense being alive. So in a way, at the end, it's a selfish thing, you know. I might be not nice to you purely because I'm a nice person, but because I can't bear it. Mm-hmm. I can't bear it, you know. I can't bear it not to say anything or not to do anything, you know. Mm. But is it, you know.
How do you think about the future?
Now. About now, you mean?
Yeah,
the future. Well, I can only. It depends what you mean. Do you? Because, you know, I don't know. Because I think the future is timeless. And you can, I mean, I think, you know, I can talk, the future is just before I look at you in the eyes, you know. And then the moment I look at you and acknowledge you, we are in the present, you know, the moment I turn, you know. That was the future, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I think. I mean, what does it mean? Yeah, I mean, if you ask me,
sure.
You know, what you think is going to happen in the next 5 years, I can say, oh, I don't know. You
know? Then I won't ask that.
Yeah, I don't know, really. What I'm trying to do is something that, I mean, what I'm trying to do at the moment is just kind of, again, you know, to have a purpose, to have a real purpose. In my life, you know, at 52, and of course, you know, there's a lot of problem, you know, and I'm not talking about this, you know, the money or this or that, but just like, you know, existential problem, questioning all the time and being depressed, you know, which is a natural condition, you know. So yes, but in a way, more or less, I think I've always been depressed, you know, if you really. But if you tell your doctor, you know, he ask you, do you feel like self-harming? And then you ask, you know, what do you mean by self-harming or killing yourself? And you think, if I was going to kill myself, I wouldn't see it as a self-harm. Mm-hmm. And self-harm is something else. Mm-hmm. It's prolonging the pain as self-harm. So then, oh, you need to see this person. You know, and actually, I have to say, I take the medicine because it does help me, you know, with the anxiety that I have. But then I think it's nothing special about the anxiety I feel. I think everybody has different strategies to deal with, you know. And At one stage I said I can't do it on my own. I need help, and I'm on medication for a few years now. Mm. And you know, I don't know. I think sometimes they're probably just placebo. Mm. I just taking them, knowing that I'm taking every day, like my blood pressure pills. I'm taking. I know that I'm attending a anxiety I have. You know.
Yeah, I understand. When you make the work, when you're thinking about the new work or when you're constructing it, is it a way of stepping into the world or stepping out of the world?
I'm not stepping in or out. I think it's more about, for me, it's about, I think it's more about bringing, feeling an image I have inside, making it everybody. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, in a way, dealing, you know, to try to get that, you know, it's a selfish thing. I'm obsessed. I mean, I have these images and I want to, and I think I need to get them out. I mean, you know, I want to get them out because I think they're beautiful, and also I think what is beautiful, it's not just the image, but it's what I believe, you know, which is this, this discussion or discourse I have with myself first. What is it that I'm doing here? What is it we're doing here? And the things that I don't like. And so in a way, through the work, through making the work, you know, I talk about these things, and then some other people can, you know, other people can have an affinity or not, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. they can see it. They have a different access, obviously, sure. to what I'm trying to do, you know? So in a way, I'm working, with things that belongs to everybody, because, you know, the moment you register something, you internalize it, and then you are, and then, you know, then you want it to get to, and then you need to, in a way, to vomit, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but, you know, you, in a more poetic sense.
You mentioned going to the gym,
yes.
your body, you mentioned dance.
Yeah.
This is a different, is it a different attribute to your body, or is it yes. the same one seen from a different point of view?
No, what's happened is that a year ago I was very depressed, basically. Very, very depressed. My blood pressure was very high. I didn't have any joy TV. And my doctor said, you know, you should go on a diet. You should get this and that. Mm. And then you should do some exercise, which is things I've done in the past. Mm. So, but this is, I was under 3 kilos, which I've never been that big, and actually started to affect me physically. Mm. And also, although I wasn't aware about, you know, I didn't have this vanity thing, you know. Mm. I saw myself, you know, but I didn't think about myself, you know. I knew I was this, you know, jolly slob, you know, in a way. And I just felt I was like a big hole that I was trying to fill in.
Yeah.
And obviously there was something, you know, before I was using drugs, then I stopped the drugs, then was food, you know. So there's a, you know, at some stage there was the art that was trying to fill that hole, and then that wasn't enough. Then I got deluded, you know, then I felt that I pushed as much as I could,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And then, with, you know, and so I went to see an health advisor. And she said, but I didn't want to go to the gym, so I don't want to do this stuff. And then I thought about making a new piece of work, and I used the piece of work as a way to lose weight, to work towards. So again, I use art. I use, you know, these things that I didn't have a clue. I also still, I mean, dance, what the fuck you mean? I mean, you know, but I'm trying to do something with dignity. Mm. You know, and so I started to train. I started to run with the dog around the park in the spring. And usually the spring for me is a very good time to to restart things. And slowly I started to see, to feel be better. And people also would say, oh, you look better, you got more color, you know, and I said, oh, I'm doing this, I'm working. And the way you set yourself up for failure, you say, I'm going to lose 30 kilos, I'm going to do this dance piece, you know, and then slowly you think, actually, maybe, you know, I'm doing dance like that, you know, we see, you know, and then, you know. So, and then we get to this, you know, and then it got serious, you know, and then I started to see, then I realized, you know, you get to a thing and then you realize that, you know, that in a way you have to step up, you know, you have to kind of decide to get a trainer, a personal trainer, and I said, I want to do this project in 8 months, and I want to get, I need, you know, and then, what do you want? I said, I want stability. It's like I couldn't even squat without falling down. You know, I couldn't do a lunge. And so I just kind of built during build in a way, do one thing I never done, looking after my physicals. You know, and I would take my body for granted. When I was young, I didn't care. I mean, you know, I was lucky, you know. I had a mini, you know, I have a problem, you know, overdose, you know. I was very lucky. We got up, walk away with that, walk away, you know, but then of course, you know, you get 50, you know, and suddenly, oh, you know, you get 48, and suddenly, you know, you shoot, you know, coke and you have a minor heart attack, you know? And then you kind of think, okay, the same question you asked 25 years ago, do you want to live or you want to die, you know? But as well, why killing yourself slowly? Just do it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, put yourself again, give yourself a reason to fight, you know? And in a way, the work is a reason, to make work is a reason.
So, if it wasn't for art, you would already be dead?
I would be dead long time ago, if it wasn't for art. And also, I think, in the last few years also, in the last 2-3 years, if it wasn't for my relationship, you know? For my partner and my dogs, I would have died. I would have called the time on myself. But I'm very concerned about my dogs. And I'm concerned about, you know, because my partner is indeed, you know, he can live without me, I'm sure, you know. But
The dogs can't.
The dog can, you know. They won't, one day I don't turn up, they won't know why, you know. So I feel. The 4 and 5, as long as they're alive, I think I'll, and I'm healthy, and there's a reason, you know, because I don't have a problem with dying, you know, I don't have issues with dying. I mean, I won't know anything about it. It's like switch the light off. I don't believe in any, you know, I don't believe in life after that. I don't, you know. So the moment something hits you, a bus hits you, you know, you're out.
Have you used the dogs in the work?
Did I use the work? I don't remember. Did I use the dogs in the work? For painting I did, yes. I painted them.
Yeah.
I was thinking about using the dogs. I mean, but my dogs are so, what you call, untrained. Because in a way,
good.
I don't believe in that. And so they're naughty. I mean, they will never behave. I mean, they will go to somebody. They will bring a ball. I mean, and I know that, you know, but yes, but no, never, but I would probably, when they died, I would stuff them, I would do something with them, I would want to hold on to them, and they, I would want them to become part of the work. But now every time I do a book, they're in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you said before you're feeling more like becoming an animal. So is it important to surround yourself with animals? I mean, these are friends. They're friends as well.
Yeah, they're friends, of course. But yes, but it's like I sleep with my dogs, you know? And my dog sleeps with me, you know? Yeah, and I like that. I like, you know, and they're trying to push me out of bed. You know? Yeah, I like that.
There's a new work in there somewhere.
but I don't know what to do with it. Yeah. But I have thought about, yeah. And but I'm very intimate with my dogs. Mm. My dogs are very, I don't know, just have, I think to me they're like, it's like if you have an intimate relationship with somebody, you know, and they bleed or something happens, you're willing to clean them.
Yeah.
You're willing, you know, I don't have this thing, you know, the dog, oh shit, you know, go shit, or the sick, you know, or I have to put my hand in the mouth because they're choking, you know. To me it's like there's no barrier, if anything I feel I brought them in my life.
In the same way
my parents brought me in their life.
Yeah, but you're more responsible for your dogs.
Yes, more responsible, yeah.
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 You're responsible for a lot of things, aren't you?
You reckon?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think everything you said is really responsible for your own existence.
Yeah, for my own existence. But again, I think it's a selfish thing. Yeah. Yeah. It's a total selfish thing.
It gives a lot back.
Yes. And of course, you know, not in a cynical way, but certainly I think, I'm not being cynical at all, but I think it's a realization, you know. I don't think that I'm more generous than you, or you are more generous than her, or he's more generous than you. I think we all have that. We have, it varies, you know. It's what does it mean to you, be generous, how you are generous. You must be generous to someone or to, you know. And the same, you know, I'm not generous to everybody, I would, I would like to think that I would respond to things. You know, in the most most helpful way, but at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, things that stop you, fears, you know. You have somebody and then they knock at your door again, and then they want more, and then take advantage, you know, et cetera, but you, it's a risk you take, you know. But at the same time, I don't think that, you know, at the end, we need to communicate, you know, and we need to feel, at the end, you know, I think essentially we are pathological, you know, we are pathological.